This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to start now. We start with a few sentences from another book of the Tanakh altogether, and that is the Book of Ruth, where Naomi has lost her husband and her two sons, She's left with two daughters-in-law who are not Jewish, and she decides to return to Israel, to Beit Lechem, the place she comes from, and says to them, takes leave of her two daughters-in-law. But they say to her, Ki itoch noshuv la'amech, no, we are not going to take leave of you, we will follow you to your nation. And Naomi says, Shovna v'nasai, loma telach v'imi, return my daughters, why should you come with me? I don't have any sons that could marry you. Even if I did get married today, I am too old to have children, and you wouldn't wait for those children, for those sons. So there's no future for you in following me back to my land. And they raised their voices and they cried. Batishak Orpo lechamuso, and Orpo, the one daughter-in-law, kissed her mother-in-law. Verus dovkobo, and Ruth cleaved to her. The two daughters-in-law, Orpah and Ruth. Orpah kisses her goodbye and goes back home. Ruth cleaves to her. What happens to Orpah? The Medrash tells us that Oso Lailo, that night, after Orpah, who's a woman who's achieved high levels of stature, of understanding, of morality, she's married into this family, to this very noble family and very righteous family, and that night after parting from Orpah, after parting from Naomi, Nisarvu bo gayos shomeo b'nei Adam, a band of 100 men had relations with her. Rabbi Tamchum omar afilu kelev echod, Rabbi Tamchum says even a dog she had relations with that night. So we have a picture of a noble woman descending to the depths of degeneracy and depravity in a matter of hours. One of the most amazing treatments of that subject is by Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, who was the Rosh Hashiva in Meir during the time that I was there, died not long ago, and treated that whole subject of the speed of degeneration with amazing insight and amazing breadth. One of the examples he gives, he deals with many examples where this happened and discusses why it happened. But one of the most important examples he brings is right from the beginning of the Torah. You've seen over and over again how the Torah itself is so brief as to merely give us the notes of what occurred during those periods of history. That what really happened in the background scenes, the dialogue that happened, the relationships that developed, the traumas and the difficulties and the turbulence, there we have to look at the oral tradition, at Chazal. And one of the most authentic sources of that background is the Targum Yonason, the Aramaic translation of the Tanakh, called the translation of Yonason ben Uziel. Very, very old Aramaic translation of the Tanakh. And in the story of Cain and Abel, he adds in some of the background information that isn't present in the text itself. And he adds in an amazing dialogue that took place between Cain and Abel moments before Abel's death. dialogue results from Cain's anger at the fact that his sacrifice was not accepted. Cain brings a sacrifice, God doesn't accept it. Hevel brings a sacrifice, God accepts it. Cain is angry. And in the development of this dialogue, he makes the following statement. Les din v'les dayon. I don't believe there is justice, I don't believe there's a judge. Les olam achron v'les lemitan agar tav l'tzidigah kaya. I don't believe there's a world to come, I don't believe that righteous people are rewarded. V'let lemifrom en reshayo. I don't believe that wicked people are punished. Hevel said, there is a justice and there is a judge and there is a world to come, and righteous people are rewarded and wicked people are punished. And they got into this theological argument, and in anger Cain kills Hevel. But Chaim Shmuel Levitz deals with the fact that a man who has communicated face to face with God moments before and does so again a few minutes later, a man who is the son of the greatest human being that ever lived, Adam, the man molded by God himself, the man breathed into with the breath of God's own life. There's never been a human being so noble, a human being so great as Adam. And Cain is his son. Cain has seen the wonders of the world. Cain has seen the miracle of creation. And literally minutes later, Cain can be saying, I don't believe in God, I don't believe in justice, I don't believe in morality, I don't believe in anything. Ask Cain Shmuel Levitz, how can that happen so quickly? How can a person lose his faith that quickly? And Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz explores the impact of loss, of detachment, the impact of the fall. And he quotes a Gemara that very few people successfully explain. The Gemara says in Chagiga Daf Hei, Rebbe, the great Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, Havanakit Sefer Kinos, was reading a book of Kinos. It was Tisha B'Av, and he was reading Eicha. The Kokari Begave, reading inside it, Kimata Lahai Psuke, when he came to the following verse, where it says, Hishlich Mishomayim Oretz, God threw from the heavens to the earth the glory of Jerusalem. A verse in Eicha. As he read that verse, Nofal Min Yode, the book fell out of his hands. Omar, and he said these words, Me igro rom lebiro amiksa. From the highest, from towering heights to the lowest depths. That was the comment he made as his book fell. And the Chaim Shmuel Levitz says, what's that all about? Why then? Why when his book falls? What's that relevant? And he says, you can imagine him sitting and reading, and as it comes to that verse, God threw down the glory of Jerusalem from the height, from towering heights to these depths. His book falls, and the book probably breaks. The binding probably gets damaged. And he looks at the book, and he realizes the damage to the book is not from its being on the floor. The damage to the book is from the fall. And he explores the fact that people aren't damaged by where they are. People are damaged by where they've come from, by where they've fallen from. And of course we have it in various different areas of life. We have it in areas of life, in an economic sense, we have a great deal of it. A person who is used to a certain standard of living, a person who has lived on a certain income, lived on $1 million a year, and things are tough and he's got to adjust to $500,000 a year, that's very, very hard, and he finds it very devastating. It shatters his self-esteem. And the person living on $150,000 a year says, what a chutzpah for him to have shattered self-esteem at $500,000 a year. What I could do with $500,000 a year, my self-esteem would be fine. It's not where you are, it's where you've come from. It's the fall that hurts, it's not the status. We have it in markets. When the market was, what's it at the moment, Martin? What's it today? What's the Dow today? So when the market was 7,800 a year ago, everybody was jubilant. The market's 7,800 flight attendant today, everybody's miserable. It's the same figure. Big difference when it's on the way up and it's on the way down. When you've come from 9-4, whatever it was, 9-3-7, and you're at 7-8, that's a problem. When you've come from 6-5 and it's at 7-8, that's great. We cannot cope with fall. We cannot cope with the impact of gravity. We get damaged by the fall, not by the position. You can lie on the floor, the book can lie on the floor, it doesn't get damaged. It falls, and it gets damaged. Cain had just fallen. His sacrifice was rejected. He'd brought a sacrifice, he'd taken a risk, he'd made an offering, and God had said, no, thank you. We learned in the Gemara Shiur this evening what the impact of the risk of offering a gift is, and what the pleasure of its acceptance is, and the extent to which we want to avoid rejection, because we know the damage of rejection. And Cain was rejected. Says Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz, when a person suffers rejection, he loses everything. He's in danger of losing everything. His whole self-value, his whole way of viewing himself, and therefore his view of the world starts changing. One views the world very differently when one is on the way up to the way one views the world when one is on the way down. That motion is terribly important to understand and to capture, the motion of upward movement at all times. Far more important than where you are. Whether it's in an economic sense, whether it's an intellectual sense, whether it's in a family sense, whether it's in a religious sense. The need to be moving forward, the need to be elevating, the need to be projecting upwards is far more important than where you are. How religious a person is totally irrelevant. What's important is how religious was he yesterday and how religious will he be tomorrow. The gradient is what's important. Where he's going is what's important, not where he is. Where he is irrelevant. How wealthy a person is not important. The question is he expanding or is he contracting? Is he going forward? Is he going down? That's how we evaluate. When we invest in a business, what do we look for? We don't look for a business that's worth a lot of money. That's irrelevant. What we look for is, what do we believe it's going to be worth in 2 years' time, in 5 years' time, in 10 years' time? That's what we invest in. We invest in growth. And when we ourselves are growing and developing, we invest in ourselves. We feel confident. We take things on. We look at the world in a much more generous way than we do when we're on the way down. When a person's on the way down, he takes a very jaundiced view of the world around him, even of God himself. And he runs the risk of losing everything he had in his time of greatness. And there's the beautiful Chazal of King Solomon, when he's dethroned temporarily, how he retains his sense of kingship over his walking stick. That's all he had to rule over. But he ruled over his walking stick, so that he would still see himself as king, even if it's just king of a walking stick, and not lose that capacity of being a king. And so it was with Orpah. Orpah detaches herself from Naomi. That detachment represents a measure of rejection. Naomi said, go home. Naomi said, there's no future for you. I cannot give you anything. I cannot be anything to you. Naomi was basically rejecting her. And the impact of that rejection was a complete abandonment of the entire value system she developed all the time she'd lived with Naomi. And in one night it's gone. She's a nothing. She's a nobody. One night, she's depraved. The human being has that capacity to degenerate very quickly. It's very difficult to grow that quickly. In all things, the building process is long, it's slow, but to destroy, destruction can take place in a flash. One word can destroy. One moment of neglect, very, very quickly, a lifetime of investment can be wiped out by carelessness, by lack of attention, by distractiveness, by mischievousness. So what's the option? What does one do about that? That means when one becomes detached from the source of one's spiritual input, the danger is depravity. The danger is not, well, I'm detached a little bit, I'll reattach sometime. That's not the danger. That might happen, but it might not happen. It's conceivable that temporary, that momentary detachment from a spiritual source of input can cause immediate and utter depravity. So what do you do? What did Ruth do? Rut and Naomi function as twins almost. They're following Rut and Orpah, function as twins, following their mother-in-law Naomi. Naomi speaks the same words to them both. She doesn't differentiate, she speaks in the plural. She says, my daughters, I cannot offer you, either of you, anything. At what point do they part? Orpah decides to go back home. The Rus Dovkobo, Rus attaches herself to Naomi. We have the choice to attach, we have the choice to detach. Detachment is not a one-sided thing. Naomi tried to detach herself from her two daughters-in-law because she felt they would be better off without her. One accepted the detachment, one rejected the detachment. You don't have to accept detachment. One can rebel against detachment. One can insist upon attachment. What is the means of insisting on attachment? That one can become a leech. Imagine such a stray, you want to get rid of somebody, and the person says, I'm not going. I'm opting for attachment. So I'm staying. Imagine such a thing, you know, the shear's over, and I want to go home already, and somebody comes and says, forget it, you're not going home, I'm attached, you're going home, I'm coming with you. Get rid of, no, I have the right, you said, I have the right to choose attachment, and I'm attaching myself. What do you do? How do you prevent the leech? The Gemara asks an even more fundamental question. There's a verse that says, "Vatem hadavekim ba'Hashem elokechem chayim kulchem hayom." You, those of you who choose to cleave to God, who choose attachment to God, are all living today. All living doesn't mean you've all survived. You can survive without being attached to God. But chayim means you're alive, you're vital. You who have chosen to attach yourselves to God all experience vitality this day. That's interesting. How do you attach yourself to God now? Now become a leech to God. Where do you plug in? Where is he? What do you hang on to? God is spiritual. We're told, God is a consuming fire. He's a force of energy. How can you get near him to attach yourself to him? That the Torah says, those of you who have attached yourself to God have vitality today. Where's the attachment? Elo explains to the Gemara, how do you attach yourself to God? Kol ha-meisi bitoi le-talmid chochem. You marry your daughter to a Talmid Chochem. Now we've talked about what a Talmid Chochem is before in the shir, and we've explained, I don't want to go into a great detail. A Talmid Chochem is the epitome of the model of the Torah personality. And there are not many around today. So if you think you know some, the chances are you don't. They're rare. They're very rare people. You find the Talmid Chochem and you marry your daughter to him. Or another way of doing it is, you do business for a Talmid Chochem. What does doing business for a Talmid Chochem mean? Explains Rashi. Mitasek b'momen Talmid Chochem kedei lahagia leyodon schar. V'hem penuyim lasot b'teira. You go to the Talmid Chochem and you say, you know what, Mr. Talmid Chochem, you're wasting your time working. That's very nice that you want to work and all that, but you could do much more teaching and studying, being independent of that responsibility. Why don't you give me your money and I'll invest it? And I will manage your money for you. And you'll live off the profits I'll generate for you, and that way you'll be able to dedicate yourself to Torah. Notice you don't come to the Talmid Chochem and say, you could do better off learning, so you know what? I'll pay for you. Because what would the Talmid Chochem say? I'm not interested. Back to the Gemara Shul this evening. If he says, sure, great thing. That means I can stop working and you'll pay me to learn. Great. That's the first thing you know is not a Talmid Chochem. That's for sure he's not a Talmid Chochem. If he's willing to be so indebted, if he's willing to take, you know he's not a Talmid Chochem. So the Talmid Chochem would never accept that. But to go to him and say, you've got certain funds, I'll maximize those funds. I'll make that money work for you. And you won't have to work. You'll live of your own money, but I'll simply manage your funds for you. And the third thing is Hamahane Talmidei Chachomim Min Chosef. Some other way to give benefit to a Talmid Chacham through one's own property. You lease him your house, you lease him a car, whatever he needs, you do something for him that he benefits from. That's a very strange Gemara. Look at what the Gemara is dealing with. Can you imagine any other religion that deals with how to cleave to God? Can you imagine anything more spiritual than that? Is there a more spiritual, mystical, metaphysical question than how does man cleave to God? So imagine how Eastern religion will deal with that. With meditation and with all sorts of things, and strip yourself of all possessions and interests in this world, and that's how Eastern religion will do it. And Christianity has its way of doing it. What about our religion? How does man attach himself to God? Become a fund manager for a Talmid Chacham. Does that make sense? Marry your daughter to a Talmid Chacham. Lease him a motor vehicle. That's how you come close to God. What is that absurdity? The only way you can come close to God is to come close to godliness. And the only place you will find godliness is not meditating in a shul, and not even out on the mountains and in the forests. Then you'll find nature. You'll find spirituality. You'll find soulfulness, but you won't find God. The only place you'll find God is in a vital, dynamic, creative Talmid Chacham. There you'll see God. There you'll see the mind of a God working in the way he reasons with the Torah. There you'll see the personality of a God working in the way he deals with his moral dilemmas. There you'll come closest to godliness. But you're a leech. What does he want? You're hanging around. So how are you going to do that? Make sure that you're not a leech. And the only way not to be a leech is to be doing business with him. You're investing money for him. So when you call him up and you say, you know, the Downs has just taken another drop. The Dow has just taken another drop. Should we invest on? What's he going to say? Stop bothering me. Is that what he's going to say? I don't want to speak to you. No, he won't. He'll say, sure, let's talk about it. What do you recommend? What should we do? And you'll say, you know what? Let's not talk about it over the phone. There's some interesting financial reports of various different companies I would like to show you. Let's have lunch together this afternoon. He says, sure. All of a sudden, his financial advisor is having lunch to him. What happens if one of the rabbis in the town phones him up and says, Rabbi so-and-so, don't we have lunch together today? What's the time of talking to say? Do me a favor. I'm busy. Leave me alone. I'm doing fine. He doesn't want to be disturbed. But if you're a business partner of his, if you're investing his money for him, there's a basis on which the relationship occurs where he's benefiting. You're contributing. You're not taking from him. You're not a leech. You're building him. Of course he's going to want to relate to you. And it's an interesting thing that colleagues of mine have told me, and I've experienced it too. A rabbi will invite people for a dinner, or he'll be talking to people, whatever the circumstances. What do they tend to talk about? What do they tend to talk about? This one tells you about something he read in the art scrolls, and this one tells you about a shiur he went to, and this one tells you about some religious discussion he was having with somebody else. And I've always said, I think I've mentioned even in this shiur before, I can't imagine meeting a nuclear physicist and talking to him about my views on nuclear physics. I can't imagine that. I can't imagine meeting one of the world's leaders in any area, mathematics, English literature, and telling him my views on Shakespeare. I would be embarrassed. What does he want to hear my views on Shakespeare for? I would talk to him about the field that I know something about, that I can share with him, something that he can benefit from as well. When it comes to Torah, there is an insufficient understanding of the fact that relationships in Torah are created in a very mundane area, just by helping one another, doing things for one another that each party is good at. If the Talmid Chacham is good at teaching Torah, then let him teach you Torah. If you're good at managing funds, when you meet the Talmid Chacham, don't tell him about the latest art scroll book you read. Tell him about what the markets are doing. He'll be much more interested. Much more interested. because you'll be dealing in an area, you'll be talking to you in an area where you can make a contribution, where you're standing on your own feet, where you're the expert. Much more important for him. And when the Gemara deals with the issue of how do you come close to God, come close to God by using your expertise in helping a godly man. That's the way you'll come closer to God, because you'll be dealing with as an equal with him. You won't be dealing with him as a student. You won't be dealing with him as a disciple. You'll be dealing with him as an equal, because you're dealing in the area where you're strong. You're dealing in the area where he benefits. That's the non-leeching aspect of it. So yes, we can choose to cleave. That there's only one way you can choose to cleave in a way where the person you're cleaving to doesn't want to shake you off. And that's if you're contributing to that relationship in the area in which you're strong. And Ruth chooses to do that. Ruth chooses to stay with Naomi and serve Naomi, take care of her, contribute to Naomi's welfare, contribute to Naomi's well-being, so that Naomi can grow through the relationship as well. That's what Ruth chooses to do. Orpah goes off. And that's the choice they each make. What's the outcome of that choice? Years later, Orpah has a descendant, and his name is Goliath. Goliath. What is Goliath? Goliath is the archetype of arrogance. What does he say, those of you who prepared some of the reading here? Verse 16. Verse 9, top of the second page. Am I not the Philistine, while you are the servants of Shaul? Choose yourselves a man and let him come down to me. If he can fight and kill me, we will be slaves to you. And if I defeat him and kill him, you will be slaves to us and serve us. Then the Philistine said, I have disgraced the battalions of Israel this day. Give me a man and we will fight together. And so he goes on. In verse 23, further down, the champion went forth from the Philistine battalions. Goliath the Philistine of Gath was his name, and spoke the above words, and David heard. Absolute arrogance. What does he rely on? Strength, power that he achieves, that he acquires. In his case, he has physical stature, he's 9 foot tall, has a strong armor, skilled in the arts of battle. He has physical strength, and he totally trusts in his ability to crush any enemy that comes before him. And he's never encountered a worthy opponent. What about Ruth? Ruth, who chooses to cleave, who chooses to serve, so that she can maintain a relationship that is valuable to Naomi, not just to herself. Ruth also has a descendant, and his name is David. And so in the descendants of these two women, we have the coming together of these opponents, David and Goliath. Goliath, the epitome of arrogance. And what about David? David comes along. And takes an interest in verse 26. David spoke to the men standing with him, saying, what have you done for the man who slays the Philistine and removes disgrace from Israel? This young boy, the shepherd. So there's people saying, you know, if anybody can get rid of the Philistine of Goliath, there'll be some kind of reward. For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he disgraces the battalions of the living God? So the people told him regarding this matter, saying, such and such shall be done for the man who kills him. Eliab, his older brother, heard he was talking to the men, and Eliab became angry with David. And you remember, we dealt with that anger. It was because of this anger and his propensity for it that Eliab didn't become king. And said, why did you come down here, and with whom did you leave those few sheep in the wilderness? I am aware of your willfulness and your evil thoughts, that you have come down here in order to watch the fighting. David says, what have I done now? Was it not mere talk? He then turned away from him towards someone else and said the same thing to him. The people answered him as before. What is Eliab angry with? Eliab is angry in sight of the same arrogance in David that Goliath was displaying. That's what he's arrogant about. Well, that's what he's angry about. And we see that coming out a little bit further. I'm skipping. We're going to do this chapter in sequence next week. But I just want to give you some kind of sense of it. In verse 32, David said to Saul, "Let no man lose heart because of him. Your servant will go forth and fight this Philistine." But Saul said to David, "You cannot go forth to this Philistine to fight with him. You're a lad, while he's a warrior from his youth." David said to Saul, "Your servant was a shepherd for his father among the flocks. The lion or the bear would come and carry off a sheep. It would attack me. I would grab onto its beard and strike it and kill it. Your servant has slain even lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be like one of them, for he has disgraced the battalions of the living God." You see the same kind of arrogance? Two arrogant people standing face to face. One young boy, who's never been in the army, never held a weapon, telling us how you can kill lions, bears, Goliath, and anything. And Goliath said, "Try and find yourself somebody who can fight me." And Eliab gets angry at the arrogance of David. Is the arrogance? Do you remember we redefined arrogance some weeks ago? And we redefined arrogance not as being confidence. Confidence is not arrogance. Arrogance is only when one's own perception of one's own value is incongruent with the responsibility one's willing to take. If I think I'm king, that's fine, as long as I'm willing to take the responsibilities of king. If I act like a king but I'm not willing to take the responsibilities of the king, that's arrogance. That was arrogance redefined, the way we worked it. Humility is aligning responsibility with self-perception. Arrogance is self-perception and responsibility out of alignment. Now, what's important in the case of David is two things. The one is he compares Goliath to the lion and the bear. What's the comparison? Does that mean every hunter is a warrior? Does that mean anybody who can shoot a lion can fight a war? Two different skills. What's the one going to do with the other? But look at the wording carefully. David says to Saul, your servant, 36, has slain even lion and bear. Before that, 35. I would go after it. Sorry, one back, 34. David said to Saul, your servant was a shepherd for his father among the flocks. The lion or the bear would come and carry off a sheep from the flock. Why that introduction? Why doesn't he just say to Saul, I have killed lions and bears. Who cares whether I was a shepherd or not? I've killed lions and bears. What does he say? My protectiveness for my flock is such that I get such energy, such passion, and such focus when anything or anyone threatens my charge that I am completely confident in my ability to overcome it. I'm not fighting the lion because I'm a hunter. I'm not fighting the lion because I hate lions. I'm fighting the lion because the lion is threatening my sheep. And when I can identify with the victim, the aggressor has no chance. And then what does he say further on? 36. Your servant has slain even lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be like one of them, for he has disgraced the battalions of the living God. I am ready to kill this man. Why am I ready to kill him? Not because he's done anything to me. Not because I despise him. I'm ready to kill him because he's disgraced the battalions of the living God. That energy, that passion that gets into me when my sheep are threatened is in me right now. And I know I can go for him. Then David said, Hashem, who rescued me from the hand of the lion and from the hand of the bear, he will rescue me from this Philistine. And that's the critical part. When you believe that your confidence is sourced by God, then together with your confidence comes moral responsibility. You owe something to God. You are responsible to God. When you believe that your strength comes from your own resources, you owe nothing to anybody. And that's the difference between arrogance and humility. Humility does not mean I have no capability. I'm a nebeth, I can't do it. That's not humility. That's being a shlemiel. Humility is, I can do anything when God is with me. That's humility. And arrogance is, I can do anything. Full stop, period. That's the difference. And so from Orpah, we have the product of I can do anything. And from Ruth, we have the product of I can do anything if God is behind me. I can do anything because if God is behind me, not only does God empower me and give me the energy, but I have to reciprocate with moral responsibility towards God. That's not arrogance, that's humility. And so in Orpah's choosing to detach, the subsequent fall breeds arrogance. But when the person has lost his spiritual energy, his source of spiritual energy, when the person feels detached from his source of spiritual value, all he can do is disgrace and devalue other people. He's dropped. Once you've dropped, once you're low, all you can look at is ways to make other people even lower. When a person has a source of spiritual upliftment, when a person has a source of spiritual energy, when a person is attached to God, when a person is on the way up, he has no need to make anybody feel in any way less than himself. He has no reason to in any way degrade himself. The other day we took our kids to Universal Studios, and I think I might have mentioned once before that I remember being told the very first time we visited the United States how important it was to go there in order to understand life here. And it was interesting that as they took us, and man, a bridge that nearly collapses, and one of the kids said, "Did you notice we didn't move at all?" Of course we didn't move at all. We had the feeling of movement because everything else was moving. And then they take you through that kind of avalanche, and again they said, "We weren't moving at all." Of course we weren't moving. We made everything else move, and that made us feel like we're moving. And there are two ways to experience elevation. The one is to elevate yourself, but that's hard. That's really hard. You've got to fight gravity. To elevate yourself. The investment, the energy, and you know the trouble with elevating yourself? You can spend 2 years elevating yourself, and you can lose concentration for one moment, and you're dead. So it's much easier to simulate it. And to simulate is use Universal Studios where make everything around you go down, and that feels as if you're soaring. And the only difference is, you're not. That's the only difference. The feeling is you are. So if you want the feeling of elevation, simulate. And the way we simulate is by bringing other people down. Remember the cynicism, we talked about the cynic. The cynic is the individual who feels his own progress, his own value, by devaluing everything around him. He thinks that if everything around him is worthless, then he must be valuable. It's like the businessman who undermines and berates his competitors. He thinks that by convincing his customers that his competitors are useless, his customer will think that he's valuable. If his customer's an idiot, maybe he will. But that's not reality. Reality is that elevation comes from climbing. Elevation comes from defying gravity. Elevation comes from constant effort and constant energy and not losing focus and not losing attention for a moment, because that one moment's fall with Cain and Abel, the one moment's fall with Orpah and many other such examples, in one moment of a fall, everything's lost. So of course it's easier to simulate. Goliath is the great simulator, the man who makes himself feel invulnerable because he belittles everybody around him. What's the key to the fact that it's all simulation? His armor. If you're so great and you're so powerful, why such armor? What are you scared of? And David? No armor. Saul offers him the armor. He tries it on. It limits him. It inhibits him. He wants to be flexible. He's got to move. Get rid of the armor. I don't need the armor. I've got to have speed of movement. And David, with his speed of movement, because he's in the movement business, David's on the go. From the time we meet him, which is now, until the day of his death, David is on the go. He doesn't sit still for a moment, and we're going to watch it, and we're going to track him. We're going to follow him in this dynamic, constant movement of King David. Goliath is this heavy, stable, static threat of a menace. He derives all of his impact from his ability to undermine his environment and those around him. And these two forces come face to face. Goliath, the force of might. Goliath, the force of of stability and false security. Goliath, the epitome of arrogance, meets nimble, flexible, brilliant young David. And the two come face to face in this David's first battle, a battle which we'll study in greater detail next Monday evening. We have a few minutes for questions if anybody wants to ask anything on the shiur.